Today, inside the impossible everything bubble. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, world's latest post covering finance and property news. Yesterday, the NASDAQ 100 closed at 22,248, its first record since February, in a remarkable turnaround for that index, which has fallen earlier as much as 23% from its previous peak. The market's biggest names powered the overall index, compensating for smaller gains further down the market cap spectrum. An equal weight version of the NASDAQ was up a milder 26% since its low in April. An index of mid-cap stocks is 20% higher, while the Russell 2000 index is up 23%. Compare that with Microchip Technology and Palantir Technologies, both of which have jumped at least 80% since the index's April 8th low. Nvidia rose 252.31, with a market cap now overtaking Apple again, which remains down 20% this year as it continues to face heightened geopolitical uncertainty and it's perceived as being behind the curve. Ongoing optimism about artificial intelligence has been another prime driver. Microsoft Corp, for example, has gone from one record to the next on AI optimism, while Broadcom and Oracle also rallied on AI-related tailwinds. And of course, Nvidia issued that blockbuster report last month. Tesla has been similarly volatile, especially in the aftermath of a high-profile clash between CEO Elon Musk and Trump, which led to multiple downgrades amid concerns about its outlook. But beyond the apparent easing of Middle East tensions, the current rally owes a lot to pauses and exemptions on the tariff front, but it's also built on the back of big tech earnings, which has reassured investors about the group's fundamentals and growth prospects, even in the face of a macro outlook that seems to be shifting by the day. While trade policies continue to be a question mark, most analysts seem to agree that the risks have diminished. A federal appeals court held on June the 10th that US President Donald Trump can continue to enforce his tariffs for now, after the US Court of International Trade in May ruled that he'd misused an emergency law to implement them. Repeated delays or exemptions, though, have given rise to the so-called taco trade, short for Trump always chickens out. And I covered this in my last post over the weekend. Now, the S&P 500 also recorded forward PE earnings above 22 times, which is way above long-term averages and frankly seems hard to explain, given the uncertainty about the tariff wars. And in fact, more broadly, we are seeing price bubbles across stocks, property, gold, Bitcoin, and other asset classes. So we need to be asking what is really driving all of this. Now, there are clues for those who want to see them, though many prefer to look the other way. For example, we know the world owes $26 trillion more US assets than Americans own abroad. In fact, this US net international investment position has doubled in the past 5 years. The potential partial unwinding of this is probably underappreciated by investors and analysts, especially if the US is seen as to be experiencing slowing growth and higher public debt and perhaps higher inflation. And we also know that equity ownership is becoming more concentrated in this US data. The top 1% owns 51% of the $62 trillion worth of household equity and mutual funds. That's up from 43% in 1990. The next 9% holds 36% of the funds. That's the same as in 1990. But the next 40% holds just 12% of assets. That's down from 19% in 1990. And the other half, yes, 50% of households own 1% of total assets. And that's precisely the same as 1990. So you can see that there are some winners, but there are also many losers. Or again, we should be looking at the money supply question, the amount of liquidity created by central banks and government as public debt spirals higher. In fact, the US money supply grew 4.5% after a fall earlier as the Federal Reserve reduced its balance sheet. That rise is the biggest year-on-year increase since July 2022. So after a brief hiatus, money printing is back, baby. And if you plot the growth of broad money in Australia and real home price growth, the correlation is stark and for many surprising. Home price growth is linked to money flows, of course, via both government debt expanding and private mortgage debt, which has continued to grow way faster than inflation. This pumps home prices higher, and because incomes are not following, makes affordability worse, much worse. And this forces many bad decisions, as Marco recently posted. A new survey found 45% of first home buyers who bought in the last year regret their decision. Reasons were thinking they paid too much, didn't save a higher deposit to reduce the loan size, and bought in the wrong area. This is all more signs of a toxic property market, where buying in consumes the minds of young people who should be focused on enjoying their life, being productive, raising a family, or doing everything else that makes them happy. To write about that. And of course, gold, which has risen significantly over the past year, and Bitcoin are also in bubbly territory, which suggests that the more you look, the more you see signs of an everything bubble. Which begs the question, what is really driving this, and can it continue, and what if it pops? Well, the other day, I caught up with Harry Dent, the author and economist, to get his latest take on said bubble. This conversation is worth listening to, even if you disagree with him, because I think he raises some really critical issues for us to consider, especially at this time. So let's play that interview. Well, now I'm joined by Harry Dent, the famous author and economist. Harry, welcome back. Nice to see you on the show again. And look, I really want to spend a bit of time with you on three things. The first, though, the mega trends, you know, the demographic trends, the economic trends, and specifically the debt trends, because you've been calling for a long, long time that these are important long-term trends to watch.
They are, and the entire developed world is peaking here demographically, okay? I mean, one of the things that happens, one of the tricks in life is the more fluent you get, the more you say, oh, my gosh, I got to get my kids in the best school and stuff. People, as they get more fluent, have fewer kids. That's pretty much universal. That's why the third world has almost all the babies. They're the poorest part of the world. So the whole developed world is peaking between about 2007, that was the peak of the baby boom, 1961, plus their peak in spending 46 years. So that hit in late 2007. Martin, that's something I was forecasting all the way back to the early mid 80s, that we'd have this great boom that nobody would believe. And then it would just suddenly kind of flatten out. And then it's kind of like sideways with the millennial generation. And that's not just the US, but that's Northern Europe. And it's Australia and New Zealand, but particularly Australia and Sweden and Norway and Scandinavia, that are the outliers that have such strong births in Norway and Sweden, and such strong immigration from such high quality countries like Asia, Southeast Asia and China, all that they actually, Australia's not peaking here. Okay, but the U.S. and Europe are, between 2007 and 2037, we would have had and started to have what would have been more like the 1930s, a Great Depression in 2008. Ben Bernanke was the Fed chairman in the U.S. His thesis was the Great Depression. So he was like me when 2008 hit. I'm like, this is 1930, folks. Okay, and that's the same thing he got. So, but because of that, the Federal Reserve and central banks around the world have just the most massive stimulus in history. I count 27 trillion, two-thirds of its nonstop government deficits, one-third plain old money printing, throwing money in. The deficits hit the economy harder. The financial, money printing gooses up financial prices, asset prices, and valuations the most. But this has caused the greatest longest, and I mean Martin by far, bubble in history. I go back all the way to when stocks were created in late 1700s. You can't find a real bubble that lasts more than 5 to 6 years, okay? And again, classic, late 24 to late 29. The first bubble this time from late 94 into early 2000, 5.5 years is the longest major bubbles have lasted in the stock market. And on top of that, this is an everything bubble. The Roaring 20s was not an everything bubble. Real estate, it was so hard to borrow money back then, 50% down, 5-year terms for mortgages, and much more scrutiny that you couldn't speculate in real estate like you can now. So this is stocks, real estate, commodities, even gold. Everybody, Peter Schiff and people who argue with me about the downturn, he's forecasting it. He sees gold going to 5,000. I'm like, no, gold has already bubbled to over, to 3,500 here, and is probably peaking here with the other bubbles. So this is commodities, gold, real estate, stocks, everything. And Martin, that's the most unique thing about this time. That has never happened in concert and globally around the world. I mean, and emerging countries had peaked first, but they've had strong peaks. EEM is a good ETF that tracks that. So this is something, I mean, most financial advisors, and responsibly so, 80, 90% of the time would say, hey, folks, just sit this out and rebalance, don't panic. I'm like, no, I'm sorry. You don't come back from a 1929 to 32 crash of 89% in the Dow, which is like the NASDAQ or the QQQs today. That was the leading edge high-tech companies in the Dow back then, the auto and General Electric and electricity companies. That was the leading edge back then. And now it's crypto and AI, and so that's when you see bubbles. But this one should have peaked or started to peak in 2007 when the baby boom peaked. And again, simplest indicator, Martin, I came up with in the early 80s, way back, just move forward the birth index, which I have to adjust for immigrants, which is more complicated, but it can be done accurately, by the way, with a bell curve of immigrants' ages and stuff. You move that forward 46 years for the verifiable peak in spending, 46 in the US and 47 in Asia and some other countries. But 46 to 47 is when the average person in developed countries around the world spends the most in their entire lifetime, plateaus after that, and eventually goes down into retirement after. This is predictable stuff. I mean, economists don't eat. I mean, I took economics for the first majored for the first three courses and had to quit because there was nothing there. Economists pretty much agreed nobody can predict the economy past the next election because it's all politics. And I'm like, no, opposite. I don't even take politics into account except for short-term stuff like now. It's fundamental. Generations grow up, enter the workforce, and I don't mean any time, average age 20, peak in spending, average age 46 to 47, okay? And then they retire, not at 65, at 63 on average, because women start retiring earlier. And then they die at, 79 to 80, 81, on depending on the country's health. All of this life cycle of consumers is predictable, number one. And number two, it became elevated in importance after the assembly line innovation by Henry Ford in 1914. That made everyday workers with no education 10 times more productive, and is still paying off around the world today. So demographics matters more than ever. It's always mattered. Of course, more people. And of course, people don't spend evenly over their lifetime. The main action in demographics happens between workforce entry, age 20-ish on average, and peak spending, 46, 47, depending on the country. And so we can see these surges. And that was 1983 through 2007 for the baby boom in the US and in Europe. And again, when I pull out the Australia chart, my spending wave, because of your high and high quality Asian immigrants. In other words, we're getting people from South America and Mexico that are lower income than education average. You're getting people as high or higher, mostly from Asia. So nobody has stronger immigration and more powerful immigration than Australia and New Zealand, and Australia is stronger than New Zealand. So you're my favorite country, not only to travel and speak in, and my least favorite for jet lag, by the way. But other than that, but you guys really are the best position in the developed world because you're on the cusp of Asia, where all the growth is going to be. I mean, Africa's not going to even wake up for another, several decades, okay? And it'll be the last thing to grow and urbanize and do this, but it's all going to be Asia, particularly Southeast Asia and India. Martin, the one thing I'm clear on, and even people, economists in India don't get it, India is the next China. All they have to do is just step up urbanization. They're growing at about 0.6% more urban per year. All they have to go up is China's rate of 1%, and they will be starting higher GDP per capita than China did in their boom, and go for the next 4 decades and go even higher. And so India is going to be that. And of course, no developed country better positioned, particularly Perth, by the way, in Australia, to benefit from India doing something like China did in the last 4 decades. And China, the opposite. China has already built enough infrastructure, housing, and offices to go 85% urban, which is about as high as most countries get, even though they're 67% today. So when they have the biggest bust because they had the biggest real estate bubble, makes the US look like nothing. Only Australia competes with China on the real estate bubble. By the way, that's your biggest liability with your strong demographics. China's not going to come back. China will never be the same. And real estate in general, Martin, will never be the same. Real estate has never bubbled, and certainly not everything and everywhere and globally like it has now. This has been a unique time for real estate, and real estate will not come back for a simple reason, Martin. This is my last demographic indicator. When I factor in buyers who are absolute sellers for real estate, that's what makes real estate go down and not come back as strong as stocks in the long term from a generational crash. So this is people are not going to get people going to look back at this like Achilles and Hector or something like that we're living in a time. This is the greatest, longest bubble in history. The longest bubbles I can find are 5 to 6 years, as I said, all the way back to the early 1800s, and this one is going on 16 years. And worse than that, Martin, 100%. It's not due to strong demographics. It's not due, at least past 2019, due to the strong technology trends and all things that I track and can project best in the future. It's basically all money printing, and therefore not only a crash, but this is hard to predict how severe it'll be because we've never seen a 16-year 100% artificial bubble. But I'll tell you, 16 years and 100% artificial only mean a lot worse. So this has got to be worse than the 2000-2002 tech wreck, worse than the 2007 to 2009 generational crash. Again, something I saw decades before it happened, so not unexpected. This will be the technology cycle down, the innovation technology cycle, that's a 45-year cycle, the generation cycle, a 39-year cycle down together, and this should have already been down the worst into 2022, and all this stimulus has just pushed this off 5 years or so. So I just tell investors, it's better to be, I don't mean just a little defensive, be safe than sorry here. Just give this thing the next year to see if we do finally have what I call the crash of a lifetime, like 29 to 32 more, because governments finally had to back off a bit on stimulus. They overdid COVID, so they had to back off after that. They should not have pulled out all the guns on COVID because COVID was a natural short-term disaster. Nobody would blame the economy for getting weak when everybody's sick and can't go out shopping. So they should have let the economy take a break there. Nope. They doubled down on stimulus. They blew out of that. Biggest bubble continues. And now I see nothing but this bubble's got to burst sometime here in the most likely time. is in the next 2 to 3 years, and it's likely to be closer to 29-32 crash than even the 2000 to 2002, which was the biggest tech crash, NASDAQ crash we've had. So this, all I can say is be safe, not sorry here. Timing is a little difficult since governments are fighting this, but they have had to change course. The US dropped the balance sheet $2.2 trillion. That's the first drop in stimulus. They're still running deficits stronger than ever, but it's made the stimulus closer to neutral now rather than strongly stimulative. And so this is the time we ought to see this big setback. And basically, it's going to let the markets get back to where they should be. And it's going to make the economy, for me, more predictable again. So I want this crash to happen. It sounds weird, but
We
we need
can't.
to have a big detox.
Yeah, well, we can't go on the way we're going on, can we, Harry? Because one of the observations I have is that if you look at it carefully, you could argue that what this actually is the devaluation of the value of each dollar that people have, right? So the asset bubble is actually the
You're
devaluation of
printing
money.
more dollars. Yeah, you're
Yeah,
printing more
yeah.
money. Of course it would. And but you got to, the biggest, what people think, oh, well, it might affect consumer prices. No, the biggest thing is financial assets. And the biggest number I have, Martin, in the world is a record, and a record by far, $630 trillion, 5 times global GDP in financial assets in the world. This is the biggest bubble, and it is global, and is going to affect everybody, including Australia, where you don't really have the demographic downturn we in Europe and US and all other developed countries have. But you have one of the biggest, the second biggest real estate bubble in the world compared to incomes. China's first. And you have, like everybody, a giant, everybody has a stock bubble. So this is going to affect Australia short term, but Australia would be the country I'd be investing first when things are down, because the US is going to, I mean, real estate will never fully recover from this, from my point of view. I don't think we'll ever see real estate at this prices again, particularly in the developed world. We're just not going to see it ever again in our
So
lifetime, you know.
let's just explore a bit further, because in Australia we just had an election, and one of the interesting things was that both major parties basically said we don't want to see property prices fall, right? They almost said we want to see continued sustainable growth in property, and of course they also continue to say we need high migration to support the property markets in Australia, right?
And
And
that is very true. You do need
yeah.
high migration, yes.
So the question that I've got is, governments have thrown the kitchen sink or two at the property market and more broadly at the financial system for the last 20 to 30 years. They've got to the point, I think, where it's unsustainably large. The amount of debt in the system is too large in Australia, where we're going to run deficits into the future. And the cost of the debt is now rising significantly. Look at long-term bonds. So we've actually got an economic basis which is unsustainable. And yet we've got a government who's saying we still want property prices to go on rising. How can that be?
Again, you have to, because if a bubble, the problem with bubbles is they're already greatly over exaggerated, and especially in valuations of financial assets. So if you let it even go back to normal, no, it won't go back to normal. You have to erase the bubble, and just to erase the bubble would cause like 60, 70% stock crashes around the world, and markets always overreact. So it's really going to be like the early 30s, you know, 70, 80, 90%. Nobody can stand that right now. That would be a disaster. And so you're caught in this dilemma. You either keep the bubble going, which makes it worse, more extreme, or you start to taper it, and it slaps you in the face harder than anybody expect. And then any government that purposely triggers this will look like idiots, you know. And that's the problem. There's no way to win here. If I was a government official, if I was the prime minister or the president of the United States here, whatever, I would be in coming in new like Trump. I'd be the educational person. I'd say, look, folks, this is we have created. And everybody's done this, and everybody's rooted for it, and it's come from government, business, and speculation by investors. Everything. We've created the biggest bubble in history, and we can either let this down more rationally, But it's still going to be stuff, or we can just let it blow. And frankly, the blow scenario gets it over quicker. 1929 to 32 was over in less than 3 years, and the stocks did nothing but grow forever after that. And that would have been the best time in history to buy. So, but there's no secret cure now. The only way to keep a bubble from bursting badly is not to let the bubble get out of control. And the only way to let the bubble not get out of control is you can't let debt get out of control. It is debt that adds to already generational spending and wealth that builds a natural boom. Debt leverages everything. And you can't even compare the debt ratios today in any country, especially the ones that bubble the most. And in China, oh my God. I mean, China, emerging countries don't get in as much debt as China did, okay? So China is the most leverage in the world in this bubble. And then it's really the in real estate. US really has the most dangerous, in effect, real estate bubble because we really are peaking and we don't come back ever to new highs naturally. So a big crash is going to go down strong and not come back. And Australia is the country in the middle that is a developed country that, again, if I threw up the Australia chart, I would throw it in with my emerging world section because it looks like an emerging country because of your high immigration. And again, not just high immigration, but high quality. The immigrants you're getting are probably twice the relative income as we're getting from Mexico and South America and the United States, and Europe's getting from Africa and other places. So Australia is the best house in a bad neighborhood, but I'm saying this is global, and there is no way, and I'm going to tell your audience, no way in hell we can have this global crash and Australia comes out unscathed, especially your real estate bubble. And that is what is most dear to Australia. You are number two in the world, and I'm going to be surprised if real estate doesn't go down 60 to 70%. It's going to go down 70 to 80% in China and 50 to 60% in the US. That's what is going to most affect Australians, because your economy will come back stronger because you're going to continue to be able to export to the biggest growth engine ever, and that's Southeast Asia and India.
So let's just explore a bit further, because one of the observations I have, and you know, I continue to track the financial pressure and mortgage stress on households, and we saw that interest rates were put up to try and squish inflation out, and we've now got roughly half the population struggling with those financial burdens at the moment. Rates are coming down a little bit, but people are much more leveraged up than previously. Now, the typical debt to income ratio is now 8 times in Australia for new loans, relative to 3 if you go back a couple of generations. So we seem in Australia to be addicted to the debt machine and addicted to property. There's 11 point something trillion of value sitting in property relative to just over 4 trillion in superannuation and about 3 trillion in shares. So the whole of the structure of Australia is wired to property. And in the meantime, we've shrunk the economic base of the country and we shrunk the industrial base of the country. So our manufacturing has actually reduced more and more and more. We have capital shallowing going on. So all the eggs are actually in the property market basket, which begs an important question about how is this thing going to play out?
Well, again, any downturn in history, and 29 to 32 was really kind of unusual in a way. The worst downturns are the ones where real estate is a big part of it because that affects everybody. Most people don't own that many stocks, Martin. And so that affects the top 10% that own probably 80, 90% of the stock. 60, 70, 80% of people own real estate in developed countries around the world. And so this really affects people. And a 20% crash is one thing, but when you get, I mean, the United States, Martin, I mean, this is the biggest downturn we've had since 1930, 32, was 2007 and 9. And it was because real estate went down 34%. Well, I'm talking about double that, closer to double that this time, because this real estate's gone longer and higher. And what goes up goes down. I mean, there's no other way to read it than this real estate crash is going to be substantially worse when it finally happens. And I don't know how most households survive. And I'll tell you how they do. It's going to be so bad that governments are going to have to subsidize, underwrite this whole thing somehow, and subsidize losses in real estate to people. I mean, that's the only way they can deal with that. And then, of course, that just throws more debt on the government. But of course, governments can borrow cheaper than us. And so it's still a big mess. But it's the fact that real estate has bubbled, not the fact that stocks bubbled so much. And they both bubbled, I mean, historically. But it's real estate that causes the most damage for households and companies that own a lot of real estate too. That real estate goes down, their borrowing power, everything. I mean, and like you say, they're stuck with these high payments, which they could afford in good times, but now they can't. And so this is, it's hard to read this as anything but the greatest downturn in modern history. Again, I have to keep reminding people, the only way I can compare this is going to be more like 29 to 32 than the early 80s recession or the 2000-2002 tech wreck or the 2007 to 2009 Great Recession. And they called it great. It was the worst thing since the Great Depression. This is going to be closer to 29 to 32, and I don't see how it can be otherwise. And people should be most worried about their real estate. And if you can sell real estate, we're finishing a major renovation in my house. I'm putting my house up for sale soon. I want to sell it by the end of this year. And I love this house. And I only bought it because it was a great deal, but it is bubbled so much that I'd be a fool to let millions of dollars just disappear because, I love my home. I mean, I am going to sell it, and I'm going to really hope that whoever buys it gets in trouble and I can buy it back in 2, 3, 4 years, or something like it. So I mean, I am selling my house, and that's something you don't do in ordinary stock crashes and stuff, because this is prime, most fundamentally, the biggest real estate crash in all of history, past, and I would say future. We will not see one this big even 50 years from now. Okay. Or in India, India will have their big boom peak around 2055 to 65. When they have their big crash, it won't be as bad as what we're going to see here, because people will learn from this real estate bubble and crash because it's so global and so extreme. Again, cannot compare this real estate bubble to anything in history.
And the interesting observation, and I have a number of conversations with people who are trying to work out what to do. Perhaps they're investors, perhaps they've got a little bit of money put aside, and they sort of listen to the talking heads on some of them, the mainstream media and what have you, and they go buy this, go buy that, but a lot of them are unconvinced that actually they know what they're talking about, and a lot of people feel very uncomfortable with how things are actually playing out at the moment. As I said earlier on, the value of the dollar going down, which means that assets are actually higher, but are they really? And so the question I come to is, well, investors, I think, need to be really, really thinking differently from how traditionally they would. The standard sort of, well, I'll put some in bonds and I'll put some in shares and I'll do this and I'll do that. It's almost like, no, you need a new plan now.
It's funny. I mean, one of the things you can do if you want to stay in your house, well, hedge your house. And you don't hedge your house. There's not a good real estate way to hedge your house, but stocks will go down more than housing. That's one thing I know for sure. You look at any major crash in history. So you could buy, like, let's say you could buy SQQQ, which is triple short the QQQ or the NASDAQ 100, which is the jazziest major stock index in the world. Okay. And global mostly. You could short that to hedge your house and say, look, I'm not looking, I'm not, sh you could short this to make money, but I wouldn't say be 3 times short with SQQQ because it's too volatile. Most people can't handle that. But if you're going to use it as a hedge, the 3 times leverage makes it cheap, a cheap hedge. You could hedge your house. You could say, okay, I'm going to take 20% of my house value and buy SQQQ to hedge that house. It's a hedge. And then if there is a crash, it should, my house, let's say my house goes down 16%. Well, SQQQ could go up enough to hedge that 60% in your house. So that's a you could consider hedging your house if you want to keep it. To me, the simplest thing, sell your house. I'd rather sell my house, be more modestly short the stock market. I don't like being triple short because downturns already happen in half the time and twice as fast as upturns. Fear runs faster than greed is one of my statements. Okay. So why add leverage to that? So I don't want to buy SQQ. If I'm going to buy SQQ, I'm going to buy a 30 to 40% position because it's already 3 times leverage, you know, and then I'm going to buy SQQ instead of PSQ because SQQ has a lot higher volume and is more liquid and easier to trade in a crazy market. But I don't want to be 3 times short an already violent downturn. And God knows what the government's going to do and how big they're going to step in. I mean, everything about this is going to be unprecedented because never before have governments, except for the Mississippi bubble, which was a short elite thing, created a bubble themselves. Governments 100% created the Mississippi and South Seas bubble. And they went up for 2 years and crashed in 1 year, 99%. Okay. But this is an everything bubble. Governments created it. So how they will respond, who knows? They're going to have to do something big, but they're also going to lose credibility because it's going to become more obvious suddenly that the governments did create this bubble with all this massive stimulus. And again, I've been preaching for years, $27 trillion. That's 150% of GDP has been thrown into the economy over the last 16 years to stimulate it. We should have grown, Martin, on that 6 to 7 to 8% a year just from the stimulus. And we've been struggling to grow 2 to 3, which shows you we would have been in a long-term downturn without that 27 trillion. And again, the 27 trillion is just stimulus in the US, not the total global situation in all developed countries. So this is crazy extreme, crazy stimulus. And I have to tell people, you can't think like you're saying, you can't think like normal. This is not a normal, oh, we could have a 20, 30% correction and you rebalance and it works to you, you know, and you can't time it, so don't try to. And it's true, most people can't time the markets, you know. But this is different. This is unprecedented on every degree. You don't sit through an 80, 90% stock crash or 50, 60, 70% real estate crash and ever come back from it, especially if you own a lot of either. And again, why real estate? Because real estate, most people are only 10, 20% equity into it. It's highly leveraged. It's leveraged 5 to 10 times. So it doesn't go down as much as stocks, but that's why real estate is going to damage the economy and individuals and companies more than the stock crash. Real estate is leveraged. And this is a real estate bubble that is so global and so strong and long that we can't compare it to anything in history. So all I can say, folks, this is time to just get out of the way. What do you lose if I'm wrong? You lose another 5 or 10% of your gains in the S&P or maybe real estate, probably look, but you know, but if I'm right, you save your assets, okay? Your entire assets are at risk here. And that does not happen many times in history. And even 1929 was not as risky because it was mainly a business and stock bubble. It was not primarily as much a real estate bubble. And real estate is the worst thing to go down for most people.
So I've got two other questions before we round this out. The first question relates specifically to the question of crypto, because now we have the crypto activity as well. And of course, some people are saying, well, the future of money is now the future of crypto. And of course, we have seen crypto prices, Bitcoin, for example, you know, up 110 or thereabouts, 110,000 US, back down a bit now. Some people are saying, I've got to get out of everything else because crypto is the future of money. And you know, it's not got the same fiat characteristics, which you know, is an interesting observation. But the question is that really as simple as that? Or are we actually just going through the same old thinking again with a different asset set?
Yeah, that's the best question you could possibly ask. And the biggest thing, people are seeing Bitcoin as the hedge to the downturn. What it is, it's the biggest bubble. It is. Bitcoin is a new, it's the restructuring of all financial assets and money, that 630 trillion. I mean, that's why when somebody was speaking at my own conference 4 years ago and said, this is the restructuring of all financial assets and money, that's what crypto is. I'm like, well, that's $630 trillion. That is a big deal. And it's going to make everything about that more tradable, more transparent, everything cheap. I mean, it's going to transform money. But every time something new emerges, like automobiles or electricity in the early 1900s, and now crypto and AI and all this sort of stuff. Crypto and AI are the two big things. One's transforming financial assets and money. The other one transforms work. And that, I mean, AI, I used to call people, say, did you see AI coming? I said, look at my books. I said, the automation of managerial and professional work, that's never been done. We automated farmers, we automated clerical work, okay? And now we're going to automate managerial everything else. So this is a big deal. But so these things always bubble in the early stages. Okay, we're in where you get the most bubbles, just like in the past. And then those bubbles crash, and then fewer companies, and it shakes everything down. And what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And it's part of evolution. So we're at that bubbly stage. Like the early 1900s and roaring 20s on a 90-year cycle, which I call the super bubble cycle. And this has only happened three times in history. This is the third. And every single, here's the real insight. Recessions and deep recessions follow ordinary stock booms, okay? And business booms and economic booms. Only depressions follow bubble booms. End of story. 1836 peaked the biggest bubble in the early 1800s, biggest bubble in history back then. Great Depression, 1836 into 43, the greatest depression ever back then. And then 1929, greatest bubble ever at that point. And then what followed it? Not a recession, a Great Depression for 12 to 14 years. So what this is on that 90-year cycle, and this has been delayed. This bubble should have started to peak in 2007 with the demographic peak, and it should have peaked with the bubble cycle peak around late 2019 going into the 2020s. Okay. Well, so now we have everything, all these things pointing down. So this is why it's most likely we're going to see this, the time for this 90-year cycle to be at its worst is 2021 to 2032. That's the winter season, 11 years of a 45-year innovation cycle. And this, it's not the demographic cycles that cause bubbles. It's the innovation cycles in their early stages that are going to change the world, are going to make everything way better than anybody imagined. But that's why they get overvalued so much and bubble so much and crash so much. So this is the most dangerous time, and we will see crypto move mainstream. We will see Bitcoin. I'm saying it probably 600,000 minimum, probably closer to $1 million in the next 15 to 20 years. That's where it's going to go. But for anybody to say crypto is it, Bitcoin is like a safe haven, no, it's the next big thing. And it's the next big thing that bubbles and crashes the most. So that's the best question you could ask, because Bitcoin is the last thing I'd hold going into this downturn, and the first damn thing I would buy at the bottom, especially if it got back to its like 15,600 last 4 year cycle low. And Bitcoin's on a 4 year cycle. A friend of mine here, Michael Turpin, just put out a book on that. Clear 4 year cycle, and it peaks this year. And the biggest crash in crypto should be expected from late 2025 into the end of 2026. And everything else should come around that and probably take longer to bottom. So if I was thinking crypto was peaking early at 108,000, but now it's gone to new highs, and we'll see what it does. But I'm telling you, next year, you better really watch out. And anybody thinks Bitcoin's the safe haven, you got a huge surprise coming at you. That's going to be the biggest crash of them all, crypto and Bitcoin.
And my last question, Harry, is this. You know, you have been talking about this great, you know, resetting of markets for quite a long time, and you've got all of the data to prove it. You've also argued that governments and central banks have been pushing against this inevitability, and they've continued to stretch the elastic further and further and further and further. So I guess the question that I've got is, can they continue to push the elastic out further and try and sustain this bubble for, you know, longer than you think? And the other side of it is this also a potential recipe for a break strategy where effectively a war or something similar to war, conflict, a major conflict, could actually almost become their way out of the problem?
Yeah, I mean, war is a good way out. But, you know, I don't know who would go to war with what. I mean, Russia's already, the Ukraine's tougher than they thought. U.S. is backing them, so they're getting nowhere there. I think Putin's learning a hard life. I think, I have a geopolitical cycle as well, Martin, that's like 18 years positive and 17, 18 years negative. We're since early 2020s, we're going into a positive geopolitical cycle. And I see this thing about Russia trying to invade Ukraine and failing at it. And they are failing at it. Okay. It is not going to, they've lost a million, they have a million killed or wounded. So I didn't even realize that till just this week. It's a huge price to pay. So the message to Putin is, wake up, you Neanderthal, down top-down dictator in a bottoms-up age of free market capitalism and democracy, which are both their opposite systems. One rewards merit and one rewards everybody equally, but they're both bottoms-up system, not to be managed from the top down. Russia's a Neanderthal here, and so is China. China is going to have the biggest bubble burst because they supercharged an already supercharged bubble, and their real estate bubble makes our bubble in the US or your bubble in Australia look like nothing. So China is going to prove, I think, to the world that governments should not be manipulating the economy. They should orchestrate free market capitalism and demographic, you know, strength and stuff and encourage that. And Australia is going to look like forever the model of not just immigration driven, because you can't rely on affluent people. They're going to predictably have fewer kids. You have to have an immigration model if you're a wealthy country. And Australia is by far the most successful and consistent one in the world. And you are going to have a big bubble. You had one of the biggest bubbles in real estate, so it will have to burst, and that's in your nation's long-term interest. High real estate is not good. It crowds out spending everything else, okay? And it's the same damn house. I mean, why pay five times for the same house? I mean, houses in the US, I'm sure in Australia, you go back 20, 30 years, it's 4 to 5x for the same everyday house. That's not a good thing. People are spending all their money for the same house. Everything else gets cheaper, okay? So this is a good reset, but it's going to be painful for people who own a lot of real estate and people who don't see it coming. And unfortunately, I can scream all I want, and I'm lucky to reach a couple percent, Martin, and that's all I can do. I'm not going to reach any more than that, never have been able to.
So my last question then as we close out this conversation is, for the mum and dad investor, at this point in time, what is the one thing that they need to be thinking about?
Again, you have to look at all your financial assets. It's easy to sell stocks. I'd say you got stocks, just take a break, okay? Just give me 1 year to see if this thing starts to set in, because this is the most likely time for it to set in. There's no way to predict this. The government has so manipulated the economy, nothing works as good as it used to, but this is the time where they have backed off enough in stimulus so it's closer to neutral, that the economy can do what it wants to do and flush out these bubbles, okay? But particularly look at your real estate. That real estate is where people are not rational, okay? It's my home, my beloved home. Okay, well then, okay, if you really can't sell your home because it's too beloved, then consider hedging that. And I gave a strategy earlier for that, okay? Just, you know, take 20% of your home value and put that in SQQQ, and that would be a good hedge for that, and you don't have to hold that hedge forever, just enough to protect it. And then you may do some different stuff, but really consider selling really. And again, if you have a lot of people have a primary home and a vacation home, well, at least sell the vacation home, okay? At least sell the more expendable home. And vacation homes tend to bubble more and crash more than primary home in nice solid urban areas and suburban areas and stuff. But I'm just telling people, I mean, it's the hardest thing to do, but I am selling my house and I love my house and I'd love to stay in it, but I am not, I could lose 60%. I've calculated I could use 60% of the value of my house that has tripled since I bought it in just a few years, Martin. And that's scary. I tell you right there, you're in trouble, okay? And I only bought it warning people about this housing bubble because it was such a good deal and I felt like I couldn't lose money. Well, I'm not gonna, if it crashed, I would not lose money at this point, okay? But I don't want to lose millions of dollars in something that I can easily sell and buy back in 2 or 3 years. So I rent for 2 or 3 years. I'll rent a damn castle for what I'm gonna save here. And so people should really consider, look at their real estate hard. Am I willing to stay in this house if it means losing 40 to 70% of its value and being slow to come back? And that's more true in the US than Australia. It'd be probably quicker to come back, but I don't even think real estate's ever going to come back at these levels, even in Australia with your demographics and position with Asia. Because this real estate bubble was just too great. And again, you got to look, I think in Australia, you got to factor in, what if my house goes down 60%? See if you can live through that. If you can't, you are better to sell it or hedge it in some way. That's all.
Harry, I want to say thank you very much. I think the message for me is we are in bubble territory, absolutely clearly. And
Extreme bubble
yeah,
territory.
absolutely, very precarious. And also, patience is really important, right? These things are not necessarily going to sort of click over next month. This could be a little bit time down the road, but that gives people, investors, time to prepare and time to think through how to deal with some of these situations. You need to think a bit differently and you need to understand the real dynamics underpinning what's going on. And I think we've been able to explore that really well today. So I want to say thank you very much, Harry. Really appreciate it.
Martin, real quick, I have a free newsletter. It's a good, it's you get an article every week and 2 rants from me a month. So you can keep on what I'm thinking. Just go to harrydent.com and it is free to get on this newsletter. I have a paid newsletter too, but you can at least get on this new this one because you need to be listening to non-traditional voices at this time. I'm sorry, this is not the time to listen to the true and tried economists who are always going to defend what's happening and defend the bubble. And that's what everybody's doing out there. Well, it's not that bad because no, bubbles are bubbles. They look like bubbles. They quack like bubbles. They walk like bubbles. And you can't even compare, particularly this real estate bubble, to anything in history. So anybody tells me this is not a bubble, I'm taking their head off and I'll do it right in public because this is insane. You've got to be blind to look at these trends in real estate and stocks and say this is not a bubble. You can't, again, I can't compare it in length or extreme or in height to any bubble in history, anywhere, anytime. That's a bubble.
Harry Dent, thank you very much. Appreciate your insights as always. Great to catch up. So there you have it. Now, whether you agree with Dent or not, it poses to me some critical questions about how much of a bubble territory we're in and when will it pop? And what can you do to protect yourself should it do so? Certainly, the signs are there for those who want to see them that we are in bubble territory. But as for when the bubble pops, well, who knows? I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.